Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the coronavirus pandemic has caused increased support for the closure of markets selling illegal wildlife across Southeast Asia. That information comes from a recent public opinion study by the World Wildlife Fund. The nonprofit group based in Switzerland surveyed about 5,000 people in March in three Southeast Asian nations and in Hong Kong and Japan. About 93% of people who answered questions said illegal markets selling wildlife should be closed to prevent future pandemics. Scientists believe it is likely that the virus came from a wildlife market in the Chinese city of Wuhan. Bats, pangolins, and other animals known to spread coronaviruses are kept close to each other in very bad conditions in such markets. Christy Williams is the WWF's Asia Pacific director. She said in a news conference, "This is no longer a wildlife problem. It is a global security and human health and economic problem." Support for an end to the illegal wildlife trade was strongest in Myanmar. Wildlife has been traded openly in the country for years. About 33% of those surveyed in Vietnam said the crisis had led them to stop using wildlife products. Grace Hua is the Illegal Wildlife Trade Program Manager at WWF Myanmar. She said in a statement, "COVID is a wake-up call. The rampant unchecked trade in wildlife is a risk not only to health and the economy, but to the region." China has recently introduced a ban on all farming and use of live wild animals. But the ban does not cover the trade in animals as pets or for traditional medicine. Vietnam's prime minister has ordered the agriculture ministry to introduce a similar ban. Jeremy Douglas is the Southeast Asia and Pacific representative for the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime. He said some of the trade had been driven underground. He told Reuters by phone that he is concerned about areas on the Myanmar-China border controlled by ethnic armed groups. Those areas have long been a center for wildlife trafficking.
Sweden has not banned public gatherings, like most countries have, because of the coronavirus pandemic. Crowds recently gathered near the waterfront in Stockholm to enjoy the sun. Anders Tegnell said he is not worried. He is the country's medical official, leading the fight against the coronavirus pandemic. The 63-year-old has become famous in Sweden. He appears on television every day. He tries to calmly explain the development of the outbreak. Countries across Europe have restricted the movement of their citizens, but Sweden has not. Tegnell says Sweden is finding a different way that is more sustainable. Sweden is using what some call herd immunity. This can involve letting people become infected so that large numbers of people develop immunity in the population. President Donald Trump has said that Sweden is suffering as the result. But Swedish Health Minister Lena Hallengren recently told the Associated Press that the country is not trying herd immunity. Sweden has banned gatherings larger than 50 people and closed schools for older children and universities. It has told those over 70 to stay home to avoid the virus. Schools for younger children, restaurants, and most businesses are still open. It appears to be normal life. But financial expert Johan Klokar says it is not normal life. He and his wife work from home and avoid going out. They see few people, and they limit their son to seeing people at school and sports activities. Society is functioning, but I think it's limited, Klokar said. We basically stay at home. Most businesses in Sweden are still open, but the economic cost of the pandemic is already being felt. Last week, unemployment rose by 25,350 Swedes, officials said. It is a greater one-week rise in joblessness than during the 2008 financial crisis. Nearby, neighboring Denmark is already considering reopening society. The country put a lockdown in place 4 weeks ago, closing schools, borders, and businesses. This week, the Prime Minister said acting quickly had helped Denmark avoid the tragedy that hit Italy and Spain. Together, those two nations have had 37,000 deaths. They are just beginning to consider a return to normal life. For weeks, the percentage of COVID-19 cases and deaths in Sweden and Denmark were about the same. But while the economic results of the lockdown are being felt in Denmark, Sweden's death rate is now nearly double Denmark's. After a sharp increase in deaths in Sweden, Prime Minister Stefan Löfven asked for an emergency law permitting the quick closure of public spaces and transportation if needed. Löfven also warned citizens to prepare for possibly thousands of deaths. Tegnell, however, said that Sweden's way is still the most effective, but he admitted that the future is unclear. He believes Sweden will avoid the sudden increase in infections that may occur when a lockdown is removed. I think both Norway and Denmark are now very concerned about how you stop this complete lockdown in a way so you don't cause this wave to come immediately when you start loosening up, he said. I'm Jill Robbins.
Many students think about how to best spend their time while studying. But what comes before study sessions can be important too, especially if you want to improve your memory of what you have learned. In today's education tips, we will explore different ways that you can improve your memory and learning. We will examine some useful, no-cost things you can do before you study. Three important ideas to think about before studying include exercise, study location, and pre-study tests. Let's look at each of these in turn. Before you study, doing cardiovascular exercise may help you better remember what you learn. High-intensity exercise may be especially helpful. In a 2018 study published in the journal Physiology and Behavior, researchers found that a group of young people who did 15 minutes of high-intensity training on a treadmill remembered more words. Some studies have also shown high-intensity exercise to help improve the memories of older people. Other studies suggest the importance of different kinds of exercise. It seems that both long, slow cardiovascular exercise and high-intensity exercise have different effects on memory. Researchers have suggested combining the two to get the best effects for your memory. The important idea is this: exercise is good for your memory. Even if you cannot exercise right before a study session, it is still probably a good idea to be active in general. Location is also important for improving your learning. While it is good to have a desk or a special study area, some research suggests that changing where you study could help you remember more of what you study. Our memories sometimes depend on things in our environment. For example, a book might remind you of something interesting or strange you learned while reading it. Environmental context and human memory, a famous study on memory, dealt with the question of memory and our surroundings. Researchers Smith, Glenberg, and Bjork found that environmental context played a big part in how well people remembered words. The researchers noted that subjects who learned from a list remembered an average of 15.9 words, while subjects who learned in two different contexts remembered an average of 24.4 words. Be sure to plan your location before you start to study. You might want to try studying in different places. Perhaps one day you could study in your room, and then the next day you could study in the kitchen or outside. You do not have to change locations every day, but try to at least sometimes. We have talked about exercise and location. Now let's talk about a third way you can improve your study session: taking a pre-study test. Students often study with a test in mind. They consider the test the final step to show how much they have learned. But students need to test themselves often. Testing is one of the best ways to make yourself remember new information. In 2018, researchers found that students who took a test before learning new material did much better after studying the material. The research was published in the Journal of Experimental Psychology. The students failed on the tests, but they were better able to remember the material than students who were only asked to read the information. The testing effect appears to be attributable, in part, to the role unsuccessful tests play in enhancing future learning, the researchers wrote. So, try to take a pre-study test. If you are using a textbook, you might want to look to the end of the chapter and do a few practice questions before you read it. You could look at some important words at the end of a chapter of an English book, for example, and you could ask yourself what they mean or how they are used. While you might not know the answer, you will probably be better able to learn and remember the answer when you study it. I'm John Russell.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We conclude the story of the 37th President of the United States, Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon's first term ended with the hope for a complete American withdrawal from the war in Vietnam. Yet, Americans were still angry about the war and its economic effects on life at home. Inflation and unemployment were both high. Some political observers thought Nixon would not win a second term. Nixon, however, was sure the American people would support him. He did not actively campaign in the state primary elections leading up to the Republican nominating convention. He focused much of his attention on foreign policy, including his historic trip to China in February 1972. In May, he traveled to Austria, the Soviet Union, Iran, and Poland. In Moscow, he signed the first Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, or SALT, with the Soviets. But back in Washington, something happened. It was a small incident, but one that would have a huge effect. On June 17, 1972, five men wearing surgical gloves broke into the headquarters of the Democratic Party. The Democratic National Committee offices were located in one of the buildings in a complex called Watergate. Police caught the burglars, and at the time, the incident did not seem very important. But the men carried papers that linked them to top officials in the Nixon White House. The question was, did the president know what was going on? Nixon denied any wrongdoing. In time, the Watergate break-in would lead to a congressional investigation. But in the summer of 1972, attention focused on the presidential nominating conventions. Democrats met in Miami Beach, Florida, and chose George McGovern, a senator from South Dakota, as their candidate for president. The Republicans also met in Miami Beach and, as expected, nominated Richard Nixon for a second term. McGovern, a liberal, attacked Nixon for his policies on Vietnam. However, Nixon easily won the 1972 election. He defeated McGovern, carrying 49 of the 50 states. But the shadow of Watergate would not go away. Two young reporters for the Washington Post, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, had been following the story since the break-in. In early 1973, they found evidence that linked the break-in to White House officials. The evidence also showed that these officials tried to use government agencies to hide the connection. The burglars had been financed with money connected to the committee to re-elect the president. Pressure grew for a full investigation. In April, President Nixon ordered the Justice Department to carry it out. Attorney General Elliot Richardson appointed law professor Archibald Cox as a special prosecutor to lead the investigation.
The committee will come to Alma.
In May, a special Senate committee began its own investigation. A former White House lawyer, John Dean, provided the major evidence.
It is my honest belief that while the president was involved, that he did not realize or appreciate at any time the implications of his involvement. And I think that when the facts come out, I hope the president is forgiven.
By July, the public learned that President Nixon had made tape recordings of some of his discussions and telephone calls. The Senate committee asked him for some of the tapes. Nixon refused. He said, "The President of the United States has a constitutional right to keep such records private." A federal judge, John Sirica, ordered the president to surrender the tapes. Lawyers for the president took the case to the Supreme Court. The High Court supported Sirica's decision. After that, pressure increased for Nixon to cooperate. In October, he offered to provide written transcripts of parts of the recordings. Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor, rejected the offer. So Nixon ordered Attorney General Richardson to dismiss him. Richardson, the nation's top law enforcement officer, refused. Instead, he resigned, as did his deputy, William Ruckelshaus, when Nixon ordered him to fire Cox.
The Watergate drama has taken a half year to unfold. The president's unique actions in firing two popular and respected members of the executive branch and forcing a third to quit took less than 8 hours. The impact of all this, clearly colossal and yet to be measured.
Jerry Landay reporting for ABC News. The incident happened on a Saturday night and became known as the Saturday Night Massacre. Nixon then had Acting Attorney General Robert Bork dismiss Cox, and the president eliminated the office of special prosecutor. He gave the Justice Department the responsibility of continuing the investigation. President Nixon had another political problem in addition to Watergate. In late 1973, his vice president, Spiro Agnew, was forced to resign. A court had found Agnew guilty of violating tax laws. President Nixon asked Gerald Ford to become the new vice president. Ford was a longtime member of Congress from Michigan. By that time, some members of Congress were talking about trying to remove Nixon from office. Was the president covering up important evidence in the Watergate case? Was he, in fact, guilty of crimes? In April 1974, Nixon surrendered some of the recordings of conversations in his office. However, three important ones were missing. The Nixon administration tried to explain, saying the tape machine had failed to record two of those conversations. The third recording, it said, had been erased accidentally. This became known as the famous 18-minute gap. Many Americans did not believe these explanations. 2 months later, the Supreme Court ruled that a president cannot hold back evidence in a criminal case. It said there is no presidential right of privacy in such a case. Congress moved ahead with efforts to bring charges against the president.
Congress now has no alternative but to institute impeachment proceedings.
In July 1974, a committee in the House of Representatives proposed to impeach Nixon, that is, put the president on trial in the Senate. If Nixon were found guilty of crimes connected to the Watergate case, he would be removed from office. Finally, Nixon surrendered the last of the documents sought by congressional investigators. These documents appeared to provide proof that the president had ordered a cover-up of evidence in the Watergate burglary. Every president promises to protect and defend the Constitution. The congressional investigation showed that Nixon had repeatedly misused government agencies in an effort to hide wrongdoing and punish his critics. The hearings also showed that he had tried to block the investigation. On August 8, 1974, Richard Nixon spoke to the nation. His long struggle to remain in office was over.
Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
By resigning, Nixon avoided impeachment and possible imprisonment. Never before had an American president resigned. On August 9th, Nixon's vice president, Gerald Ford, was sworn in as the nation's 38th president. Soon after becoming president, Gerald Ford made a surprise announcement.
I deeply believe in equal justice for all Americans, whatever their station or former station. But it is not the ultimate fate of Richard Nixon that most concerns me, though surely it deeply troubles every decent and every compassionate person. My concern is the immediate future of this great country.
He pardoned Richard Nixon. Many Americans criticized Ford for doing this, but the new president believed he had good reason. Ford wanted to deal with the other problems facing the nation. He did not want Watergate to go on and on, but the investigation did go on. A number of officials in the Nixon administration went to prison. The effects of Watergate on public opinion and public policy would be felt for years to come. For example, Congress passed laws designed to prevent an administration from using its power to punish opponents. Nixon's abuses also led Congress to order government agencies to provide more information about their intelligence gathering activities. Nixon's actions violated the basic trust between the American public and their elected officials. It led to more aggressive reporting by a new generation of journalists hoping to follow in the footsteps of Woodward and Bernstein. Their coverage of Watergate won a Pulitzer Prize, one of journalism's top awards, and led to a movie based on their book, All the President's Men. It starred Robert Redford as Bob Woodward and Dustin Hoffman as Carl Bernstein. Jason Robards played Washington Post executive editor Ben Bratton.
You got more than one source.
Yes, Harry.
Who are they?
Sloan.
Sloan and who else?
And there's another guy, Justice, who so far won't confirm the names of the other two who control the fund that we're working on.
What deep throat.
He's not a source on this.
But do any of them have an axe?
No.
Personal?
No.
Political? Sexual? Is there anything at all on Mitchell?
No.
Then can we use the names?
No.
When is somebody gonna go on the record in this story?
You guys are about to write a story that says the former attorney general, the highest-ranking law enforcement officer in this country, is a crook. Just be sure you're right.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.
This is the